Welcome to a brand new week of Political Rewind. Boy, and it's a busy week, especially in Washington with the health care legislation still pending. We're going to talk about that. We'll talk a little bit at some point during the show, since everybody else is, about Trump and his war with some of the NFL players and with Steph Curry of the NBA. And we got some good local and state stories we'll talk about as well with Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the AJC. You now read him on Wednesdays and Sunday. Today's Wednesday's the first Wednesday for your column.
That's right. Yep. Shifting days a little bit, spreading it out a little bit more to make my life more comfortable.
So on a day like today, do you already know what you're going to write about for Wednesday, or are you starting to think of?
I've already started lining it up. It's going to be. I'm writing about the third political campaign that's now underway. You have the mayor's race. You have the 18 cycle races. But you've got a race that ends in February on the Public Service Commission about whether Georgia Power gets to keep building the two new nuclear reactors at Plant Vogtle.
Huge. Brian Robinson, Republican strategist, former communications director for Governor Nathan Deal. Brian, Tim Echols is often on this show, and we love having him on. I've never understood. I mean, I get the power of the PSC. But, man, have you ever sat through a rate hearing? I got to say, you couldn't pay me enough to be a part of that.
No, I haven't, but I have slammed my head up against a brick wall, and I'd imagine the experience is probably pretty similar.
We're glad you're here. Buddy Darden, former 7th District Democratic Congressman from up in Cobb County. It's been too long since you've been here. I'm glad you're back.
I'm glad to be back, and thanks for asking me to come back.
Yeah. Somebody, and I think it may have been our friend Todd Rehm, has taken to trying to get you called Uncle Buddy.
I think it fits.
I never have been thought of in avuncular terms before. However, I'll accept whatever appellation people want to give me.
Granddaddy Darden doesn't sound right.
No. All right. A couple of headlines. John Barrow. Who, of course, served in Congress as a Democrat from around the Athens area, finally lost the seat. The last white Democrat from the South, male Democrat from the South.
From the deep South.
From the deep South. He's been gone 3 years, and he's now announced, and I read it on the AJC Political Insider, that he's going to come back. He's going to run for the Democratic nomination for Secretary of State.
Which is a surprise, because, of course, he's a lawyer by trade, so you might say, oh, AG would be a good fit for him. But I think this is a good move.
Why?
Because you've got a field on the Republican side that is either inexperienced or, especially in the case of Josh McCune, it really appeals to the Christian conservative, the faction of the GOP, which means Barrow, who is very good about playing to the middle, might be able to peel off a few votes there. And it's financially feasible, I think.
I totally agree, and that is their thinking internally. And I don't think that taking on Chris Carr is the right comeback opportunity, because our current attorney general will be very strong going into next election year. I believe he's very popular. He's picked on the right issues. He's been very visible on those issues, things such as human trafficking, things that have interest beyond just the Republican base.
And he's a Johnny Isaacson protege.
He's got that Isaacson network, but also the Deal network. He's a Deal appointee for two different jobs. So I think Chris is probably not a good target. I don't think they could beat him. I think they have an open seat in Secretary of State, which is always more appealing than running against a popular incumbent. So I think it's a rational decision. I think it could line up to be one of the more exciting races on the ballot this year.
Especially if this Russian hacking of state election offices takes off.
Yeah, but yeah, I think the Republicans may be as hard on Secretary of State Kemp and the need for reform as the Democrats will be.
Well, for all the reasons you have been mentioning and talking about, I was among a number of people who encouraged John Barrow to run, former Congressman Barrow, to run for Secretary of State, because I think he's got the background, I think he's got the knowledge, and some of us Also had the same opinion about Chris Carr, in that we have a very high regard for him and felt like that this is not an open seat, and that the chances, as Jim said, that he would have Josh McCoon as the nominee are quite good, I think. And while that might be appealing in a primary, I think as far as the general election, it would be less appealing and would be a high-profile race.
So we don't tend to look – I mean, the governor's race, always the one that everybody talks about all the time. We don't spend as much time, any of us, I think, ruminating about some of those – races a little bit down ballot. But, Buddy, one of the reasons this could prove to be interesting, if in fact Barrow does have a chance, as both Brian and Jim suggest is possible, is we might see a break on the lock that Republicans have on all of the constitutional offices in the state of Georgia.
Plus, John has a good political name. Barrow goes back to the very beginning of this state, and John has shown an ability to appeal to the middle, and which is what you want to do during a general election as opposed to an election in a primary.
And truthfully, this is what we saw on the Republican side decades ago, that you saw a few gang, Bobby Baker on the PSC,
right.
You saw Linda Schrenko.
When Democrats had a hold on all the constitutional offices.
Yeah, yeah. You saw Linda Schrenko become the first Republican state school superintendent.
That worked out really well.
yes. Inmate number 1123.
Yeah. One other quick headline that I think is interesting, and we'll follow it. We're not going to get into it today, but there's a Senate, a Republican Senate proposal that we think is going to be made public today, is going to be dropped up in Washington today, that will create a pathway to legalization for the so-called Dreamers. And the Republicans who've on the bill are Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina, James Lankford of Oklahoma. They look at this as a Republican-friendly bill because, although it will provide protection for the Dreamers, it will not allow them to sponsor family members to come to the United States. That's a contentious issue in all of this, Jim.
Yeah, so does the story tell you whether they incorporate, how much of David Perdue's and Tom Cotton's bill they incorporate?
It does not. So that'll be interesting to take a look at. But chain migration is really emerging as a big concern, Buddy.
Well, it appears to me that the Republicans have gotten the message, which Newt Gingrich tried to give them back when he was running for president, that no one wants to see good people who are members of their community contributing to society uprooted and sent back due to circumstances over which they had no concern or no fault. And so consequently, it appears that they're the middle of the political thought seems to be that it's not these people's fault and that they ought to be accommodated if at all possible. They present no security threat, no threat. They are paying taxes. They're making contributions to society. They are members of their churches. Their kids attend school. And so why punish them for the sins of the parents?
You've got so much on the immigration front that's not doable. You've got the wall, which is going to be a major hurdle to get the funding for that through. You've got Trump's promise to deport the 11 million people who are already over here. That's also undoable. But chain migration, you're entering an area where you might be able to deal with Democrats.
All right. That'll be interesting to see as it moves forward. You can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Several of you already are, including Michael Jablonski, former a lawyer who worked for Governor Roy Barnes, very active in Democratic Party politics. And, Michael, you give us a line that we can use to lead into what we want to talk about next. You say, private planes are trouble for the Purdue's in politics. Sonny's ethics fine was based on failing to disclose aircraft use. So, yes, there have been some problems with Georgians in private aircraft before. And Tom Price is still in the middle of a controversy right now over his use, some $400,000+ use of charter planes, according to Politico, which originally reported the story. But here, Brian Robinson, is what I think is interesting, the development this weekend. We've talked about this story several times now as it's unfolded. But over the weekend, President Trump was he was out. I'm frankly not quite sure where this took place, but he was in a place where reporters were able to shout questions at him. The first question shouted at him had to do with Steve Mnuchin, his Treasury Secretary's use of a charter aircraft, a request to take one on his honeymoon. He did take one to Fort Knox, Kentucky, with his wife to watch the total eclipse of the sun. And Trump basically deflected that, saying something, well, I don't think he ever took those flights. But then somebody asked about Tom Price, and the president said, we're looking into this, and really echoed what we've heard from other White House insiders, anonymous sources, who have said there is concern about Tom Price in this regard.
Wow, this puts me in an awkward spot, doesn't it?
Explain why.
I can handle that for you.
I think what you've got to be concerned about, if you're looking at this as a Republican, is the sheer number of them, the fact that there was 24 in basically a 5 or 6 month period. That seems to be a lot. And I'll tell you, as someone who knows Tom Price and has been around him for more than a decade and watched his career, this is one of the most calculating, smart, politically savvy Georgia politicians that I've ever been around. And so to even allow himself to be perceived as wasting taxpayer dollars when he's been such a hardcore fiscal hawk all these years, and at the same time you're cutting Navigator programs to help people sign up on Obamacare, you're cutting costs in ways that hurt or that impact, let's say, lower income Americans. To do this sends the wrong symbol and definitely hurts with the Trump administration ethos of drain the swamp and don't waste our money. Don't act like you're better than us. I think it was a misstep. I hope they give Tom the chance to rebound, and because he is an asset. We need him in that job.
He pretty much said issued his mea culpa on Saturday on Fox News.
Well, what he said was that he will stop flying charter flights while the investigation.
And he confessed that the optics do not look good.
Right.
That's true. And that's, I mean, that's. For a reaction like that this soon, I think that says something. But I think Brian, he also might be, you know, with healthcare not moving, Trump may be in one of those moods.
Yeah.
Let me give it a try this way. Tom Price is in the big leagues now, and he made a rookie mistake. And when you're in Congress, the degree of scrutiny is so much less than it is when you're a high-profile cabinet official. And you can get away with a lot of things in Congress that if you were out in the administration, everybody knew all about, perhaps it wouldn't look so good. And I don't think that Tom Price has a dishonest bone in his body. However, has some bad judgment here, not only on his staff's part, but on his as well, and one of these things that he can't recall. So I think the best way he can put it behind him is just issues may a couple, say it's a mistake, and move forward.
Well, and then that's a question.
Can I just say one of the funniest things I've seen in this? Because I can enjoy humor even in the middle of political controversy. But his initial response was, I use these to go and meet average, everyday Americans.
To get out of the Beltway.
To get outside the Beltway. And one of the places was like the Aspen Ideas Institute or something. Where ordinary people go.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's like,
well, let
like
me
it's
point
a beer
something
festival.
Out. Let me point something out that happened, meeting ordinary people happened back when I was in Congress. I used to go back and forth most every weekend. I flew coach and so forth because I had a limited budget. But a couple of times I flew to Atlanta, and Jim Baker, who at that time was Secretary of the Treasury, was on the flight with me, and he was flying coach along with his Secret Service folks, and people were standing in line for him to sign their dollar bills. And another time I rode two or three times with former President Carter. He went back through the coach section shaking hands with everybody. And it's quite an opportunity if used properly, and I think that somebody just fell asleep at the switch with Tom Price.
So you know, I think on that you make a very good point, buddy, and I think that may be something that Tom Price considers. When you consider the times that we live in, when everything is so divisive, you know, Ivanka Trump flying back home with her family being heckled by a passenger who had to be eventually carted out. Lord knows at a time when we're talking about repealing and replacing Obamacare, you've got Tom Price as the architect. If I were him, I'm not saying he should fly private jets, but I would be very nervous about walking down airport terminals, particularly outside of the South, because people are so violent in their opinions.
How expensive would a little stick on beard and mustache be, though, compared to chartering a flight, Brian?
Well, that's we've seen him with the mustache.
In sort of defense of Tom Price, it wasn't Price himself who said he was taking these flights to get out more quick access to the real people. It was, Brian, some poor communications guy or woman in that office who had to try to explain his or her boss's behavior. You wouldn't understand what that's like, would you?
No, I've only worked for the most well-spoken and well-intentioned elected officials. And as I always joke, with Lynn Westmoreland, former Congressman Westmoreland, who's friends with everybody at the table, I worked for him, and I always joke with him that my every interview I did with reporters always started out with what Lynn meant to say was.
And in this particular case, I recall that during the Clinton administration, we had a very fine Secretary of Agriculture who came from the Congress by the name of Mike Espy from Mississippi. He couldn't adapt and adjust to the rules and the very close scrutiny, and eventually he resigned. So this is problem. It's not the first time this has ever happened, right, and probably won't be the last, right, people. But again, if you're in Congress, you're under a different set of rules, and the scrutiny is not so much.
Okay, well, then let me ask this, and we'll move on. Buddy, I asked this question on Friday's show. You weren't here, so let me give you a crack at it today. What's the outcome of this? I mean, he's no longer an elected official, so it's not as if anybody can use it against him in an election against him. Sure, if Trump is really angry about health care and decides that Tom Price should have been in Washington fighting for the bill instead of riding around the country in a jet, he could be out. But if the inspector general finds out that he was in violation of basic policy on this, I assume the most that happens is he has to write a check to pay back the cost. Yeah?
Well, he has a constituency of one,
right,
and that is Donald Trump. And as long as the president wants him there, he'll stay. And he can do almost anything other than commit a felony, and perhaps even that, and stay if the president still wants him. So he might have to pay some penalties.
Right, and again, I mean, yes, he's responsible, but we don't know why the flights were booked on a private jet. We don't know who did that.
But you know, a lot of these guys who are on the cabinet, as Trump likes to brag, are billionaires and people who are worth well over $100 million. Now, the irony is that when this is discussed on cable news, they're like, there are all these billionaires. And then there's, you know, poor little Tom Price. But poor little Tom Price was the richest member of the Georgia delegation.
Yeah.
You know, he's worth over $16 million.
Compared to you and me, Brian, he's wealthy.
He's very wealthy.
Right. All right. Yes. Let me do this. Let's get a break in real quickly because we have so much to talk about, some state issues, some local issues. Plus, I just got a tweet from Brian Robinson, who is sitting at the other end of the table, saying, on now, and we have way too much to talk about, but I'm anxious to talk about this damn anthem issue. Thanks for that tweet, Brian. Let's take a break. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, writing speeches and jokes for President Obama. David Litt was only 24 when he started.
It felt totally surreal and completely terrifying.
He went on to become senior presidential speechwriter and lead writer of 4 stand-up appearances at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. His new memoir is Thanks, Obama, My Hopey, Changey White House Years. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3, right here on your GPB station.
I went to a play yesterday, Brian, and, you know, thinking about the tweet that I just got from you, and my wife and I took a picture of us with the program for the play, and I posted it on Facebook before the show started. I tagged the actor who plays the lead in the show, saying, can't wait to see his performance, and he responded from the dressing room before the show that he was glad we were. It's just kind of like your tweet right now. Jim, you had a really interesting column that you kind of hinted about to us on the show the other day that has to do with the expansion of MARTA transit up into Cobb County, a long-time contentious issue.
Right.
But there's a new approach that you propose in your that has been proposed. Why don't you rewind this for us?
Well, this kind of grows out of a meeting that Governor Deal had with a small Cobb delegation last Monday, 7 days ago. It was kind of put into motion by Lindsay Tippins, a state senator out of West Cobb, around in my neighborhood, and he brought along a good many members of the Georgia Chamber, including Mr. Bottoms, who's the chairman. And Tippins wanted to go there. Tippins went there with the intention of trying to make sure that the governor understood that they wanted a guarantee in a new lease on this railroad line that goes up from Atlanta to Chattanooga that CSX is now moving, is now using exclusively for slate. Someday in the future, they think, you know, if it's called for, maybe that could be used for commuter rail. So that was his purpose for it. The Cobb Chamber folks kind of went off on a tangent and started talking about what could be done now. Where can this ball be moved down the road right now? Because you've got the hunt for the second Amazon headquarters, and according to the specs that Amazon has issued, Cobb County and Gwinnett County, two big Republican, two heavyweight economic engines, they'd be ruled out because of the transit issue. All right. So, and it kind of rang a bell with me. I had lunch earlier this summer with Robbie Ashe, the chairman of the MARTA board, where he was talking about alternatives that might be that might be available. And one he mentioned, and when I called him back, he mentioned it again, is the possibility that you could have a CID, a
community improvement district.
Yeah, like Cumberland, which was how the Braves got moved. It was the Cumberland CID.
This is sort of a public-private partnership,
right?
It's businesses,
exactly, and
it's
they
local
tax,
government,
and they tax themselves a little extra to give themselves some economic power here, and you could have legislation. Ash says he'd be fine with talking with the Cumberland CID. Come January, about legislation that might just allow MARTA to move up into the CID period, not the rest of Cobb County. You've got this interesting division where the business community in Cobb is moving faster on the transit issue than the politics.
Well, Buddy Darden, you certainly have been up in Cobb for a very long time. You've watched this rejection of MARTA, of transit, over and over again. Where do you think things stand now? Is it changing?
I think it is changing. I'd also point out to you that Town Center also has a CID. So that's an interesting possibility as well. Of course, it's not adjacent to the Cumberland CID, mm-hmm. but there's a tremendous amount of money, billions of dollars being spent right now, also to open up the pathway between Town Center and Cumberland. But I would say a word of caution, however, because I would be very surprised if the general public would support in Cobb an expansion of MARTA. However, I don't think there's any question that is certainly more acceptable to the people now than it would have been. It'll be a matter of dollars and cents, that is, how much our taxes, if any, would go up as a result of it countywide.
So let me ask this, and you all weigh in, if you will. But, Buddy, so what Jim is talking about, the Cumberland CID, which does encompass that area right of 285 and 75, the SunTrust Park, the new Braves Stadium, Cumberland Mall, the Galleria. I mean, that's an economically, that has the potential to be a powerful economic driver in that community. So what we're talking about, if Jim's notion is correct, is that perhaps MARTA goes up, crosses 285, but stays within the limits of that, whatever the geographical boundaries of that CID is. And I would think the people in that community would be more favorable to that, say, than maybe up in Ackworth or Kennesaw, yeah?
I do not think that it would be feasible without a favorable vote of the Cobb County Governing Authority, that is a commission.
Okay.
And we have a county commission chairman elected countywide, as well as four district commissioners. And in my view, before it could be seriously considered, you would need at least the approval or the consent of the governing authority.
Brian, Governor Deal, who has, I think it's safe to say, surprised a lot of people who were not great supporters of his early on with some of the progressive issues that he's taken on.
That's not how we would frame it, Bill.
Well, but that's, yeah. But it would be true. And, I mean, this would be an opportunity for the governor, who seems to have expressed more interest in transit than he would have, say, 5 years ago. This could be quite a legacy if he were to push this forward, yes?
Yeah, and I think it's a matter of where we are. One thing that's frustrating is I think the delay, which isn't Nathan Deal's fault, it's gone on for decades.
Oh, sure.
Is going to make this much more expensive than it would have been had we done it when we should have. That said, housing patterns have changed, and so we have an opportunity now to go to where there is density in the outer ring. There wasn't always density that makes mass transit feasible. So part of it is we're now at a place where commutes are longer and longer, it is affecting quality of life, and we have a new generation who is open to mass transit in a way that past generations were not, people who will actually use it. And one thing that we're seeing, in particularly in the Midtown area, when you've got these high-paying companies coming in, technology sector, when they're meeting with the Department of Economic Development and with Nathan Deal and Speaker Ralston and Lieutenant Governor Cagle, they're saying, we want to be on, you know, by a MARTA line. That it is part of what they are asking for. And boy, when you start talking about $100,000 jobs and 500 of them, you're going to get the ear of the leadership. And I think Ralston, Cagle, and Deal have all sounded very responsible tones on this.
Jim, your neighbors out in West Cobb, though, would probably discourage your county commissioner from voting for her. Transit.
You know, you've got in Mike Boyce, the new chairman, you have somebody who I think is willing to entertain it. Bob Ott, I think, has some. He's been one of the guys who's been in favor of using the CSX line, or at least exploring its use. You would have to, if you were going to do this, you would have to get some political buy-in from the Cobb legislative delegation, from people like Lindsay Tippins, who would have to agree to that separation of interest between the business district and the population.
You know buddy, last week on Wednesday's show, we did a meeting of the mayors. Rusty Paul, mayor of Sandy Springs, Republican mayor, and Teresa Tomlinson, Democratic mayor of Columbus. And we talked about issues that they share in common, and they both said some form of transit. But, of course, what's interesting about the way they described it is, for Rusty Paul in Sandy Springs, expanding transit would mean a matter of maybe 10 miles north of Five Points in downtown Atlanta. When Teresa Tomlinson talks about expanding, she's talking about getting rail from Columbus to Atlanta. And that two very different but perhaps important economic development tools.
Well, there's no doubt about it. We've been trying to establish something between Macon and Atlanta all these years, and it never worked. However, there's already a railroad going up from Atlanta to Chattanooga, and I think it makes good sense to try to utilize it. Without changing the subject, I want to remind you of one of the greatest and hardest political fights ever occurring in the state of Georgia was over that lease of the Western Atlantic Railroad to what was then the Louisville and Nashville Railroad.
Why was that a big fight?
Because it there was so much money there, and you're looking at an enormous asset that the state of Georgia has, and it's one which is valued at billions of dollars, and everybody wants a sweetheart deal from the state of Georgia, and I don't think the state maximized its situation last time, because every member of the House of Representatives and the legislature back then was a target for each of the two railroads. And I'm surprised that it hasn't heated up again, because that was a big money, big deal, political fight, really, of the decade over the leasing of that railroad.
I think any rail line needs to go north, whether we're talking about MARTA or we're talking about a longer passenger rail that would maybe go to Chattanooga. But regardless, it's got to go north. Any investment that would take us to Macon, Savannah, or Columbus would set us back. We've got to set priorities, because it's a very limited set of funds. We've got to go where the population is, and the population growth is going up the Georgia 400 corridor, up the 85 corridor north, and 75 corridor north. There needs to be mass transit going into Vining, Smyrna, and into this new SunTrust Park. That is such a clear priority that it should be where we look first, and getting into that thing that Jim wrote about. And then beyond that, going further up Georgia 400, I had the opportunity a few weeks ago. I had to be in Dahlonega at 8 a.m., which was brutal for this not morning person. And at 7 a.m., I was just north of the Forsyth County line, heading down up toward Dahlonega. And the backup, I mean, cars not moving. That it starts very far north of Alpharetta. I mean, I would shoot myself if I had to do this.
Where is I'm
going at Georgia 400 toward up through coming into Dahlonega. It is
awful.
But
the traffic was going the other way.
It's going south. I'm going north.
I thought you were running into
it. I was going about 80.
Yeah.
I mean 65. I mean, I was going 65. But I saw cars stop to my left going south. And so there's huge density there and lots of money there. And it's a good way to get professionals onto that. I think we need that to diversify that ridership, and it could really transform that region.
Yeah, Jim, we're going to move on, but I want to ask you one last question about this. I've said on the show many times, I grew up in Chicago. I rode the L in the subway every day. My friends in New York, same thing. My children, when we go to big cities, love the fact they can get on a subway or an L train, whatever. Is it, in fact, cultural? Is it the fact that I love the idea of transit because I grew up with it, whereas my friends who grew up here in Atlanta, the car culture is so powerful to them that they really can't even picture themselves using transit?
It's the car culture, but it is also a matter of race. From 1974 or whenever MARTA was voted in by the counties, it was that for many people of that period, the Chattahoochee River was a moat.
Is it still that way, buddy? Is race still the divider on this?
No, I don't believe it's still a divider. Of course, there are certain issues there that would be considered, but it is not an absolute divider like it used to be.
All right. Let's do this. Let's get another break out of the way. We do have a lot of Trump news to talk about, not only the NFL war, but also North Korea. So we'll take our final break of the show and come back for more on Political Rewind.
When Hurricane Irma threatened Georgia, GPB News was there.
I guess I feel safe being here because I'm with my family. I'm in the house that I grew up in.
Clothes, important papers, pictures, whatever I could in a compact car. But it's three other people and a baby.
I mean, we have a lot of people that are just, I mean, frankly, tired of natural disasters at this point.
Listen to GPB News. We tell you the whole story and we stand with the facts.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Let's touch briefly on North Korea. The president in his rally on Friday night in Huntsville, Alabama, and then on Twitter over the weekend, continued to attack North Korea and to make provocative statements. Now we learn today the foreign minister of North Korea has said, we will now shoot down American military aircraft because we believe the president has essentially declared war on us. Talk about escalation of language, if nothing else.
This is where you don't get a lot of sleep at night.
Yeah.
And you worry about a president who doesn't edit himself when it comes to Twitter, and other people are reading Twitter, and a lot of lives are at stake. And you wish you could do more than shake your head about it, but I'm not sure that you can.
Buddy, is there a possibility that President Trump's harsh rhetoric, despite the fact that it scares almost everybody, both sides, in fact could be a deterrent?
If it is a possibility, it's a very, very narrow possibility. In fact, quite to the contrary. I think that Teddy Roosevelt put it best when you said speak softly and carry a big stick, and we seem to be doing the opposite of that these days. Now, one reason that I think we may come out of this thing all right, though, is that the president appears to have put together a pretty good national security team. I'm talking about his Secretary of Defense and his National Security Advisor. And I think in the end, maybe cool heads will prevail, but I just can't see how any of this rhetoric with them, it seems almost childish, like two schoolyard boys going back and forth against one another. I think it's personally deeply beneath the dignity of the president.
I mean, just look, think of your high school bullpen, except with the two guys instead of maybe a couple knives, then with nuclear warheads in their pocket.
Brian, you know, a lot of people have speculated why John Kelly, who seems to be a very different sort than a President Trump, would have wanted to stay in that job. It is certainly conceivable that Kelly sees this as a duty. And although he can't manage the president's tweets, he may be, in fact, having a big influence on Trump in terms of the real strategy on North Korea. Could be true, as Buddy points out, the rest of that military team at the Pentagon and national security team and all those other places.
I think everybody who takes that job sees it as a duty, no matter the president, no matter Republican or Democrat. I think Rahm Emanuel saw it as a duty when he was asked by President Obama to do it. He didn't want to do it. He didn't want that job. But he felt that he had to answer the call of the commander-in-chief. And I think that's what John Kelly has done here. And he's serving honorably. And quite frankly, I think there was a competency deficit in the White House for a long time. Let no one accuse me of being an apologist for the dumb things the Trump administration has done. I think that Kelly is closing that competency deficit there in the White House. And we're not seeing as many unforced errors. Now, you're seeing the president say controversial things. You're seeing him say things that are true to his brand.
Yes, but is Kelly perhaps having an influence on how Trump, beyond the tweets, thinks about what he'd like to do in North Korea?
Yeah, I think he, along with the guys that Buddy mentioned, McMaster and Mattis, are huge, sobering influences. Look, I'm naive. I've been accused of that before, but I don't believe that Trump or anybody else or Rocket Man thinks that a nuclear war is a great idea. And I don't think anybody does. But there could, in fact, be a strategy here. There is a danger in being too weak, too. And I think Barack Obama exposed that danger. You know, it made us vulnerable in some way because everybody didn't take him seriously.
Yeah, but here's the thing. This is, you will hear Trump say this time and time again, that I don't want to be predictable. And quite frankly, in the nuclear business, that's exactly what you have to be. Yeah. You have to be predictable. Everybody has to understand where that red line is.
I go back to the thought, first, do no harm, but I do think the competence deficit appears to be closing.
All right.
In the White House.
Let's do this. Before we turn to the Trump NFL situation,
calm down, Brian.
Yeah, but Brian's really chomping at the bit. But let's at least spend a couple minutes on the fact that tomorrow is the special, the Republican runoff in the Alabama U.S. Senate special election, the election that's going to fill Jeff Sessions' seat in the U.S. Senate. And of course, we got Luther Strange, the appointed incumbent, the candidate with the backing of President Trump and Mitch McConnell, one of the few things they've agreed on yet this year. And Roy Moore, the former Alabama Supreme Court justice, who has been kicked out off the bench twice for violating federal court orders. Trump on Friday night ostensibly went to Huntsville to rally on behalf of Luther Strange, and in the middle of the rally said, you know, maybe I made a mistake here in endorsing Luther Strange, but, I mean, there's a lot riding on the president deciding to jump into this thing.
Only in Alabama could this happen, where you have an appointed senator appointed by a governor who was the attorney general who was investigating the governor, and so he put him in the Senate to get rid of him, and then the governor has since resigned. And at the same time, you have a man who's been kicked out of office for disobeying the mandates of the law twice, not just once, as you point out, but twice. And I just cannot understand what those people are thinking. Now, Luther Strange, I knew him back as a lobbyist back when I was in Congress for one of the pipeline companies, but he was a nice, affable, reasonable kind of fellow back then, and he's been making that kind of impression in Washington, but all of a sudden, he's had to toe the Trump line and say some things that really, I don't think, he believes, just to follow Trump, and then Trump comes down to campaign for him and then virtually disavows him in the middle of his endorsement speech. I don't know what's going on over there.
On Sunday, it was I got a fundraising email from a Roy Moore super PAC. And basically it was quoting Donald Trump verbatim about all the nice things it said about Roy Moore and the fact that Alabama ought to be doing the same thing that Donald Trump called for with the NFL.
I'd say I am so glad to see the national Republican establishment rallying behind Luther Strange, because it will hurt the party brand across the board if Roy Moore is the nominee there. He does, and Trump. I don't think that Trump disavowed Luther Strange in the middle of the speech. In fact, he goes, look, if y'all nominate Roy Moore, I'm going to support him. I told Luther this. I'm going to support him if he's a nominee. Here's the thing. If he's our nominee, the Democrats may win this thing. If you want to win it, nominate.
I don't think he went that far, did he?
It was this.
Yeah,
he did.
Okay. Right.
It was like Luther Strange is our best way to keep this and to see my agenda move forward.
But so, Steve Bannon is down there in favor of Roy Moore. So is Sarah Palin. I mean, what's going on?
Well, Trump addressed that too, buddy. He said all those people who are behind Roy Moore, I have fired them. So there you go.
We're going to watch how this race turns out tomorrow. I think in the long run, the national implications are that if a Roy Moore, the Steve Bannon candidate, the outsider, the Trump candidate-like candidate, can unseat a more mainstream Republican, that may start the ball rolling on any number of Republicans being primaried in 2018.
And it could have an impact on the gubernatorial race in Georgia next year.
Exactly. All right. Brian Robinson, it is time for you to unload. President Trump, I thought John Poteritz, who of course is commentary, a conservative magazine commentary, we mentioned him at the top of the show. We didn't use him by name. He said, Trump is Pavlov and we are all his dogs. This is another example of Trump finding a way to energize the base, to excite the base, perhaps because he knows that his candidate, Luther Strange, could be on the verge of going down in Alabama, and he wants to remind the base why they love him.
Well, this is such a hot button, and he is brilliant when it comes to those things that are going to get people fired up. And this is one of those that really even goes beyond his normal natural base. I think a lot of moderate Republicans are offended by whiny millionaires disrespecting our country on a national stage and expecting to get our money. You know, what really fired me up over the weekend, and I went on a Twitter storm.
Who are the whiny millionaires you're talking
about? These football
players. All right, you think they are. All right, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, this is and it's fine. I totally support their right to do it. I think Donald Trump does too. Here's the thing. No one is questioning their First Amendment rights. This is not a First Amendment issue. I do not have the right to come on your air and use a lot of profanity or things that offend you or attack Georgia Public Broadcasting and expect to get invited back. If I use my free speech rights to offend people, other people have the right to not deal with me anymore or to fire me or to not hire me. That is, and that's all Trump was saying. If you are offended by this because you love America, because you are a patriot, because you served your nation in uniform or your granddaddy did, you don't have to stand for this.
All right. So a couple things. Number one, Trump may not have said it specifically, but his Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, said the players in the NFL who take a knee, they have a right to free speech on their own time, not when they're playing in the league, because the league should establish rules that would prevent this sort of thing. But beyond that, President Trump didn't just condemn them, buddy. He said owners should fire players who take a knee during the anthem.
Well, first of all, as you might expect, I totally disagree with Brian, who I think has had a big dose of Kool-Aid in the last few days.
It's red, white, and blue Kool-Aid, buddy.
Which is so out of character from his general moderate positions. And frankly speaking, until big-time Republicans like Brian start taking the president to issue every time he does something absolutely total and demagogic and irresponsible like this, then he's going to continue to do it. But you're going to reach the saturation point, Brian, you and most moderate Republicans, you're going to reach the saturation point to the point that you're going to have to call him out at some point. And I think we're getting closer and closer to this time. But the flag belongs to everybody. The Star-Spangled Banner belongs to everybody. And the reason we have it and we honor it is because we can do exactly what we want to do. We're not a bunch of people who have to say Heil Trump or salute every time to show our love for the country. And those people love their country just as much as we do. And by the way, the only profanity I heard was from the President of the United States upon this issue.
Jim?
Yeah, first of all, I would say I would agree with Brian on the fact that politically this is a no-lose situation for Trump. I mean, this is another Confederate statues moment here, that in principle it plays well with Democrats in votes and in plurality. It plays better with Republicans. That said, I thought it was very, very interesting that not one NFL owner of a football team came out in support of Donald Trump. You had a couple remain silent. The rest pretty much told him to shut up. And that's because, yes, you are dealing with millionaires. Many of them are whiny. Many of them are not. But they have contracts, and they have really, really good agents.
We should also point out, to localize this, that the Atlanta Falcons on Sunday, most of them, as far as I could tell from the photographs I saw of it, stood arm in arm. There may have been a few kneelers, but their way of protesting, as so many other teams, they stood arm in arm. And Arthur Blank was right in the middle, standing arm in arm with his players, making a political statement.
And remember, we've got two separate arguments going right here. Trump has characterized it as a respect for the flag, respect for the Star-Spangled Banner, although we do have movements every now and then to find another easier-to-sing anthem here. And then on the other side, on the players' point of view, you have a situation where they don't think members of their community, their African-American community, are getting justice at the hands of police. And that was the basis of
And only six the week before kneeled down, and it wasn't that big a deal. After the president brought it to light, there were about 200.
Well,
so he's merely exacerbating the situation and I think trying to exploit it for his own political purpose.
And I wonder if what Jim just said, Brian, doesn't play a... Isn't it something we have to discuss? The president insisted in an interview that he never invoked race. It wasn't about race. And yet, it is about race. Whether he intended it or not, it is African-American players who have been kneeling, who have been protesting for the most part. And is this really a fight the president needs right now?
I think it's no lose, like I said. And
No, but I'm not talking about politically. I'm talking about for the good
of the
country.
Let's talk morally.
Is this a fight, given after, in the aftermath of Charlottesville, is this a fight you would want a Republican president to take on right now?
I think that, on the one hand, many, particularly Republicans, agree with what President Trump said. I think he gave voice to a deep-seated sentiment. And I'm not one to get caught up in the culture wars. In fact, I avoid those issues. But even I am offended by this statement. And I don't want to stop them. I'm not going to go counter-protest. I don't care that much. But I might not watch. I might vote with my remote control. And I think that's what the president was saying. The president is too divisive at times on these things. That there was a way to bring people together. And I think what bothers me, I'm not just seeing this as an American, I am hurt to see them kneel. It hurts me to see that, because those players and I have a birthright that we're so proud of and should be so proud of. You know, the African-American story in this country, and I would never deign to pretend to know their pathway. I know it's different than what I've walked. But the progress of the African-American community over 300 years is so remarkable, such a point of pride for this country. We're not to the mountaintop yet, but we have come a long way up. And I'm proud of that, and it hurts me that they're not.
Buddy, I wonder if the president didn't exacerbate this with his latest salvo on this, which is how proud he is of NASCAR fans because they don't disrespect the flag or the national anthem, which again, unfortunately, raises the issue, the specter that race is at the heart of all this. NASCAR fans are not a lot of, there aren't a lot of African American NASCAR fans out there.
Here's what really bothers me. Either his intentions were of a racial bent in order to divide us further, or even worse, the fact that he doesn't realize the danger here of what he's saying and the efficacy of his remarks and how people take them. I think it's probably worse that he doesn't know than the fact that he does.
I'll tell you, the other thing that bothered me in that speech, and I watched the whole 90 minutes.
I did too. It was fantastic TV.
It was, well, it was. I considered it an obligation. But I was kind of, the fact that he dismissed the head injury issue in almost the same breath.
Oh, by saying when they stopped allowing for big hits, I lost interest in the game. That was shocking.
I agree.
And that made it a little more personal. That made his remarks on the flag a little bit more personal to me.
That was very dangerous. I think anything that gives momentum to the idea that we need to go back to the way it used to be is dangerous. Like the Alex Hernandez issue came out last week where he had, at the age of 27, far advanced CTE.
Yeah, the brain of a 60-year-old.
Yeah. I mean, this is very serious.
We're almost out of time for today's show, but what is just a very quick comment from you on this, Jim. The other interesting aspect of this is the owners stood against him, despite the fact they are, revenues are not what they have been in the past. TV viewing is down, and the president is suggesting that people should turn off their TVs if they think the flag is being disrespected. This, in the long run, could have some, if not a lot, of economic impact on a sport that has been a gold mine.
It'll have some influence. I think that the sport is much too beloved to allow Trump that kind of influence. I think the head injury issue is a lot
All
more
right.
is
Pro
a, not
football
more potent.
Is a lot bigger than Donald Trump.
Oh yeah, I mean
he's
absolutely.
A blip on the screen, it'll be there before him, and it'll be there when he's gone.
My point in bringing it up really was to say that there are people looking at this with economic calculations.
Yes, yeah, you always have to look at the money.
All right, we're out of time, Buddy Darden. What a pleasure to have you back. Let's not let so much time pass before you come back the next time.
You do the inviting.
It's a deal. I will. Brian Robinson, thank you for joining us today on. It's Brian Robinson Monday, and we always like having you here. And Jim Galloway, we'll see you again on Friday's show. On Wednesday, Andy Miller of Georgia Health News comes in to talk about the health care bill, where it stands, plus these big deadlines for some very important health care subsidies that we're looking at that could have a big impact on Georgia. Jenny Ahmed, our senior producer, Olivia Rheingold, our associate producer, thank you so much for your work on today's show. I'm Bill Nigut. See you Wednesday at 2:00.